Father, thanks that Daryl can be here with us today. Would you speak through him today and help us to hear what he has to say? I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
First, I want to thank the youth group and this Sunday school class. This is in my office. So all these kids that were on here and all these papers, they did an amazing job. And it just really helps me to connect to the church, knowing that I'm being prayed for and that the Sunday school class is takes special time to remember me and the work that we do. But I love the... The whole atmosphere here at Tri-Cities and the kids, the way the kids are involved in worship, fantastic. I want to share a little bit this morning about my kids. But first I want to give a report from China. We have 8 teams that are working in that area, and it's way worse than what the news is telling you. There is probably close to 240,000 that have been killed in that earthquake and then the ensuing flood when that lake spilled over. We had a team that hiked up there. It's 6 hours right up and over the mountains. And you could see the bulldozers trying to keep that water back in that lake. And so they were forced to allow it to break. We also had another one of our teams. We have a project with orphanages in Myanmar or Burma. And that was devastating, too, the typhoon that hit in there. So, you know, there's... all over the world, we're just seeing kind of the hunger pangs of this ugly baby called the Unholy Trinity, which is cascading towards us. That's the bad news. The good news is that missions is a tremendous success. Now, I just had a birthday, and the beauty about being a Latin American missionary is a woman never gets beyond 40. So when they ask, if you're about 38, you don't get beyond 30 until you reach 40. And then they ask you, ¿cuántos años tiene? How old are you? You say, tengo 40 y pico. I have 40 and a little bit. She might be 70 years old, but she has 40 and a little bit. So, and if you're 38, you have 30 and a little bit of years. You got to love that as a woman. But anyway, for Father's Day and my birthday, long ago I've told my kids, listen, I don't need stuff. I've got a watch and it works pretty good sometimes. I've got enough shoes. I've got enough belts. I don't need ties. I don't wear ties. Really, there's nothing you can buy me that I really can't get for myself. However, if you want to buy me something that involves time spent with you. So I thought, what a great idea. I get to spend time with my kids. My daughter takes me out for a father-daughter lunch or brunch. My other daughter gets a coffee card, and then we go out for coffee together. But Coulter, my son, when this first started, he was 15, and his great idea was taking Dad to the movies, but not just the movies, to the premiere showing of Lord of the Rings. We did this 3 years in a row. Well, it starts at midnight, and it ends about 3-something in the morning. Unless it came to the Two Towers, which they showed the first one first and then the second one after that. So I wasn't getting home till 5 in the morning, just dragging. I thought, maybe I should change this. But it was a big deal for him to take Dad to Lord of the Rings. And I love the series. Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring, the Two Towers, and the Coming of the King. It so signifies the day we're in. And the whole struggle against good against evil and light against darkness. But in the first movie, and I started watching it again, like I think I've seen it twice and I'm seeing it for the third time again, and I mean, you see this mighty band of warriors that the kingdom of the earth is raising up to fight against this godless demon infested group, the orcs and Sauron's army. But it's in the Fellowship of the Ring. It's a tale of Middle Earth, where the Dark Lord Sauron has raised up an army of orcs in pursuit of world domination. They're going to take over the world. And these things, I mean, they scare the liver out of me. I mean, just seeing them come up out of the earth, it's just so demonic. And so the struggle is, the whole thing is to take Bilbo Baggins' magic ring that he's somehow gotten a hold of and to throw it in the Fire Mountain into this river of lava to have it consumed. And then that will break, it will break the back of the darkness, of the dark side. So what do? They raise up such a, you know, these so-called heroes of their side, the good guys, they're tough guys. I mean, if it was me, I would be looking for somebody else. But they have four hobbits, which are half people. They have two earthlings. One's kind of a ranger. He's a loner, and the other is the other guy is got real anger management issues and domination issues, which. He ends up getting killed off at the end of the first Fellowship of the Rings, and then they have a wizard, they have an elf, and they have a dwarf. And if the earthling has anger management issues, the dwarf has real anger management issues, and they make up this Fellowship of the Ring. And yet, what happens is. The enemy throws one thing after another at them. There's the orc army that comes along, and they split the group up. They're running through the caves, and then you have the orcs coming down from the pillars, and then these cave trolls that come after them, and which is amazing. And they've just escaped this kind of octopus that comes out of the water, and it ends towards the end of the movie. Gandalf the Grey is killed, and he's dragged down into the pit, which I think is representative of this whole battle that we're going through. But he, in the beginning of the second movie, he is resurrected to Gandalf the White, and apparently you have to change colors to rise from the dead. I was just reading up on this last night for today's message. But the battle looks lost. They are broken up. You have Boromir is slain, Gandalf is slain, Merry and Pippin are taken captive. You've got two of the hobbits cross the ford, and they're heading up through the mountains trying to take this ring and cast it in the fire. And then you have the others that are trying to get back the lost orcs. And the battle looks defeated. It looks defeated for the good side. And it looks like there's no hope. But then in the second series, they're able to recapture or take back the two hobbits. And Gandalf the White is resurrected with greater power, greater strength, greater ability. I think that's so indicative of the resurrection, the difference of the resurrection in our life. 450 years ago, I guess what it suggests to me is there's a cost to winning the battle. What do we give up to see the battle won? All through life, there's sacrifice, and to the degree of sacrifice is the degree to which there's an endowment of power. And it works on the dark side. Believe me, in witchcraft and spiritism, in the countries that I've worked in Africa, and in Cuba, where there's, and in Haiti, where there's voodoo, Cuba, there's something called Santeria, which is spirit worship. It's witchcraft and spiritism. To the degree that you sacrifice is the degree to which you're endued with power from the dark side. However, there's a huge cost. You don't sleep much. Literally, physical forces or unseen forces literally push people out of beds. And as they've related this to me, I realize, yeah, there's power, but there's power at a cost. Same for us in our plight. And in our struggle for God, to the degree that we receive power, there's a degree of sacrifice on our part, whether it's sacrifice in prayer, whether it's sacrifice through fasting. And so if you want to see God moved, it involves sacrifice for our cause. What is our sacrifice? What does it cost us to see our cause advancing for God? 450 years ago, probably about 460 now, Francisco Pizarro, who was the Spaniards would call him the liberator, the one who freed up the Americas. We would call him a tyrant and an opportunist if you live in Latin America. And he came to liberate the tribal peoples through Mexico, Central and South America, mostly in South America. And he liberated Peru of hundreds, thousands of tons of gold. And the great liberator. But he had had two forays into South America, gotten badly beaten. He had gone over with three ships, and he was on this La Isla de Gallos, or the Island of Roosters, off the coast of Colombia. And his army was decimated with the plague, and one of his men had snuck out a message saying that he was holding them in captivity, forcing them to fight. And so new troops came, a new army came, and Posado faced his men, and he drew a line in the sand, and he said, on this side is family, it's country, it's our life as you know it, it's the easy life, the good life, the pleasurable life. On this side, on my side, is hardship, it's suffering, it's sacrifice, it's warfare. But there's also the opportunity of position, of wealth, of prestige. Choose which side you're going to serve on. Most of the men stayed. When we hear about Francisco Pizarro heading up into the mountains of Tingo María in Peru, he had 350 men, but of the original men, only 13 crossed over to side with him. And, of course, the rest is history. They were able to conquer Atahualpa, who was the Inca of that day, and they had a ransom room where as high as he could reach, they filled it once with gold and twice with silver. And then there was much more gold that came later. But they all became heads of countries, heads of cities and mayors, magistrates. They all became men of great fame and renown back in Spain. But there was a sacrifice. And to get to that place, they had to make a commitment to their cause. And they knew there was going to be hardship and suffering and, for some of them, death in the plight. Is it worth it? Is it worth it to go over? When I first went into Cuba in 1993, Cuba found itself in that situation, kind of like the earthlings of that day. The Iron Curtain had fallen, or what I call the sugarcane curtain. It had crashed, and Cuba, Russia had pulled back $10.5 billion of support. There was very little hope for Cuba. They were trying to make it with their sugar industry, and the price of sugar were high, but they only did $1.5 billion a year out of sugar industry. So they had to figure out something that would bring in liquid currency, cash, into the country. And they hit upon the idea in 1993 of tourism. Tourism is by far today the biggest industry in Cuba. Anyone here been to Cuba? You're out of the will of God. You gotta go to Cuba. You really, Cuba is way better than Hawaii, 10 times better than Hawaii. They'll take good care of you. You are safer in downtown Cuba than you are in downtown Coquitlam. It is such a wonderful country. The people are fantastic, and the Spirit of God is moving. But when that whole infrastructure fell, they had a ration card that gives them enough food for 1.5 weeks. You get no meat. You get half a chicken once a month. You get a pound of rice, a pound of beans. You get one bun per person per day. So if you have little kids, you can make do, but everybody has to deal on the black market. The situation is desperate. And it looked, when I went down in 1992 and in 1993, the balseros, the rafters, were trying to leave to make their way 90 miles to America, to the shores of the Florida Keys. And just across that 90 miles, most of them were dying at sea. Out of over 100,000 that left, over 75,000 were eaten by sharks, died of malnutrition, died of from lack of water, and or were swept over and drowned. Most of them swept over and drowned by the waves. And I remember pushing them off from the beaches and asking them, why are you leaving? And the situation looked desperate. I said, is it because of Castro? No, it's not because of Castro. Is it because of communism? No, it's not because of communism. Is it because of no work? No, we work 6 days a week. Why are you leaving? They said, because there's no future here. There's no hope for our children. And so 40-some years of communism created a spiritual vacuum that God is now filling. And Cuba is the fastest growing church in the Americas, North, Central, and South America. They have grown from 1,100 churches and house churches in 1991-92 to over 17,000, nearing 18,000 a day, and they're just exploding. But there is a sacrifice. So many Cubans are leaving, given the chance. I spoke at a conference of 1,200 pastors and their wives, and I said, listen, the greater sacrifice is for you to stay, not to go, for you to stay here in North America. There are enough missionaries to Cuban missionaries to Spain. Miami has enough Cuban missionaries. And you walk into a church in Miami, and there might be 20 people. And back home, they'll be pastoring churches of 200, 300, 400. They don't have a building. They're flooding through their living rooms and out the back door and out into the backyard. But the church is alive, it's vibrant, and they are passionate for God. And so one of the pastors I met with, we went in 1993, and God called us as a ministry to come alongside, not to impose a program. And let me just say, as a missionary church, I love the groups that you're supporting because, you know, I see the pictures on your backboard. Most North Americans haven't figured it out in missions. They go in there with a program to impose their program on the national church, and the national church will never buy it. They'll never buy into it because it's not their program. And so what we do is when we first went into program, they asked us, what do you want us to do? And we said, we don't want you to do anything. We want you to do what you're already doing. What are you doing in the areas of church planning and evangelism, and how can we help? And usually it involves Bibles, literature, the Word of God, and it involves small things. We're supporting pastors still at $25, $30 a month. That's a full salary. And we are now supporting 917 pastors, 30 chaplains working in the prison systems. And let me share about this, but let me share about the type of pastors we're supporting. Most of them are laymen. In other words, they're starting off with a couple of Sunday school Bible courses. And then while they're pastoring, and they're also starting with a call of God on their lives, most of them are leaving careers as lawyers, doctors, engineers. Over 60% of them are professional in their careers in Cuba. Engineers, some of them are technicians. But they're leaving that to work full-time planting churches. Let me share about one pastor I met. His daughter worked in the Diez Mero Church, which is just outside of Havana. And as I went in there, I walked into this church, and you see a little house. And then at the back of the house, as you walk in, you realize that there's about 100 and some kids back there, and there's a bunch of adults, and the place is just alive. But if you were to walk down the street, you'd never know there's a church there but for the singing. And as I walked in, I walked in with a group from Banff, and we went in with musical instruments. They are desperate for musical instruments. I went to 14 music schools, and only a couple of them had musical instruments. I said, well, you're a music school, right? Yeah. Well, where are the instruments? Well, we don't have any instruments. Well, what do you teach in the music school? Well, we teach theory, but we're praying to God to provide us some instruments. So the last trip I went down, not the last one, but two trips ago, we took down about 40 or 50 sets of guitar strings, both electric and acoustic. We took down a guitar. I took down an accordion. If you don't think the accordion's dead, come on down to Cuba. They worked that accordion, man. It's like those old time tent revival meetings. Fantastic. And I'll tell you, those guys, I've never seen an anointing for the accordion until I got to Cuba. So I took this accordion down, and in the transit, one of the keys got broken. They still make it work. I've taken flutes down. I've taken down a bunch of guitars. We've taken down harmonicas and anything we can get into our overhead and carry on. And God just uses it. The one institute that we took into, I took some guitars down, and I gave this brother a guitar, and they have 40-some students, and they take turns practicing on that guitar. A keyboard. We took down a small keyboard, and fantastic. God just uses that for these music schools, and the training is good. But I said, well, what did you do before? They said, well, we had made a little cardboard thing of where the finger placement is on the keys, and they just practiced on the keys to hit the chords. I said, that was their keyboard until this keyboard arrived. And I thought, man, so little and yet making such an impact. And so as I'm in this, the group has, we had been praying, and it was towards the end of the week, and we prayed and asked God where we should leave this guitar. So we walked into this church, and the church was alive, over 100 people. I said, how did this church get started? The pastor said it was through my daughter. I said, where is your daughter? And she says, she's no longer with us. Our daughter was 15. She was seen as one of the youth leaders of our church. And she was just, the church was on fire, and she was involved in the youth group was going. And then she did an outreach into this community where we're at right now. And we had a feeding program where the kids didn't have enough food to eat, so they would come, and my daughter would take out food, and all these little kids were receiving basically the key meal of the day through them, and then we would give them fruit to take home to their parents. And the church began to grow through a feeding program. And it was kind of a cup of soup program. And so we helped out. We provided food for that for a couple of years while it was just getting going. And they said, what happened is our daughter got really sick. And she had we took her into the doctors. They couldn't figure out what the problem was. We had no medicines to treat her. And she got sicker and sicker. And so the church had a prayer vigil. And they fasted and prayed, believing God for a healing touch. But our daughter died. And we were devastated. We thought, here's an up-and-coming leader in the church. Why, God? Why would you take this key leader? And the mother and father said, our faces were in the dirt for 2 weeks as we cried. But we were nominal Christians. We weren't plugged in. We weren't involved. We would attend church once in a while when we felt like it. And then one day, God revealed to me that he was calling me to step in and fill the shoes of my daughter, to carry on the feeding program, to carry on the outreach into this community. So we sold the small little house that we had, and we moved to this house because this is where the church was. And we began to meet in our living room and give out the food, but we soon outgrow the living room. And so a missionary or a foreigner came along and gave us enough money to build a small little area on the back patio. And then we began to meet on the back patio. And then we came along and we helped them. We gave them $250. I thought, we'll see what they do with the $250. Came back, gave them another $200, and they built a church on the back that they call the King of Glory Church. And he said, then as I began to do this outreach and feeding program, the pastor said, listen, we don't have a pastor to send here. Why don't you serve as a pastor? So my wife and I began to do theological education by extension. We became the pastors. And now the church, we have a full church. They're now able to support me because we were supporting him. What we do is we give $25 and we make a 2-year commitment. And if it's in a smaller, difficult field, we'll carry that on 3 years, sometimes 4 years. But they can't become ordained while they're being supported from the outside. So they want to get off support. They want that church independent and being a missionary church. So that's what's so cool about Cuba. So he said, thank you for your support for helping us become pastors. And now our church is grown. And he said, God gave me a promise when I went through all this. And it's found in John chapter 12, verse 24. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it will bring forth much fruit. And then Pastor Miguel turned to me and he said, our daughter was that grain of wheat. This church was growing, it was moving, but really it wasn't until she died that it took on the life that it has now, and it became what it is today. But our daughter, her life, she was the sacrifice to see the church where it is. If you go into this area, it's actually a submarine base on the north end of Cuba. It's called Bahia Honda, Hidden Bay. And they have a submarine base, the Cuban Navy. And they don't like foreigners there. Understandable. So I took in an evangelism team, and in 3 days we saw 91 people come to Christ. It was fantastic. Now, this guy is from San Francisco, and this Pastor Mark, and he went down there. We did puppet shows. We did all kinds of stuff. But it started with one woman, and her name is Elizabeth, or Elizabeth, we would call her. Elizabeth was in her home, and she was a mathematics professor at the university. Her husband was a mechanic, and her husband, quite the womanizer. He was a drinker and a carouser and a womanizer, and she was so empty. She had no satisfaction from all the students and the training and from her job, and she realized she was missing something in her life. A friend invited her to this church, this very alive church. She went and got excited about God and about what God was doing in this church. And so she went, and the pastor, who was one of Cuba's leaders, said, "Listen, Elizabeth, why don't you," she says, "my husband won't let me come to church anymore because the church service starts at 8, and by the time I walk to a bus and then take a bus home, a lot of times there's no buses. I'm getting home at 1 and 1:30 in the morning." And so he's saying, "You can't do that. You can't be out all night." And so the pastor said, "Listen, why don't you take the church into your home and you lead a Bible study? We'll lead a Bible study, and then the fellowship can come to you." So she did. The church grew. It grew to 30, then 40, 45 people. The church was just alive in their living room. One day her husband came home and he said, "Listen," he said, you're pouring out your life into this Christianity thing. And we're Cubans. We don't believe in God. So I want you to leave the church." She said, "I can't." He says, "If you don't leave the church, then I'll leave you." And she said, "Don't ask me to make that decision. I love you, but I need God." And he said, "Then you've already made the decision." He left. He was gone for 2 days. When he came back home with another woman. Moved her into their home. And they had a garage in the back. And so he and this other woman moved into the garage. Now, they had 2 kids. And so she was brokenhearted. Meanwhile, the church continued to grow. And so Hector Hunter, this was in Havana, the president, who I just had here a couple weeks ago in Canada, the head of the Pentecostal Assemblies of God, he said, "Elizabeth, I believe God's calling you to be a missionary." And she said, "Well, I can't stay in my own house. It's ripping my heart out every time I see my husband coming home with this other woman." So he divorced her. They cut the home in half. He got the garage and all the land at the back. She got the house at the front, and she gave it over to another pastor to pastor, and then she moved to Bahia Honda. Bahia Honda, or Hidden Bay, the submarine base, was a spiritist stronghold of 5 witches. 5 sisters controlled that city, and their houses were located on the entrance and the exit of Bahia Honda, and they literally cast spells, and they literally controlled people's life through their witchcraft. I mean, very demonic. And when Elizabeth first moved there, she moved into the house of someone. There had been a church there before, but it had died because of the influence, the tremendous strongholds of darkness that came against it. And so she moved into a house where this elderly man and his wife allowed them to meet. She rented a little bedroom, and she started bringing the people together that had belonged to that other church. And it was just struggling, fledgling. Meanwhile, her son refused to come with her. Her daughter came with her, and her daughter was in her mid-teens. I think she was 17, 18. Her son became a juvenile delinquent, and her heart was broken. She felt she needed to leave and go back to Havana to take care of her son. Then her daughter got pregnant out of wedlock, and her heart was just ripped open, but she realized God was calling her to this hidden bay. And so she began to pray. Meanwhile, the spiritists in town would throw rocks on her tin roof at night, keeping her up at all hours. They would mock her when they went by. When the church was in service, the neighbors would turn up their ghetto blasts. It was just an attack of darkness. So they fasted and they prayed, and they claimed these five witches, these five sisters, for God. The most powerful of the sisters, she would run around naked in town. All the men in town were afraid of her because she would carry a knife or a machete, and she would literally attack them unprovoked. And so they were in fear of her, but she was a very powerful witch or spiritist. And so as Elizabeth and her small group began to pray for her, this woman came to them and knocked on the door, and they said, "We want your help." And Elizabeth said, what can I help you with?" She said, "My husband's leaving me. The city hates me. I can't sleep for more than an hour at night." And she said, "I have voices that constantly are speaking to me." And she says, I want to be a right living person, but I can't. There's a spirit that literally tears off my clothes." And she says, "I have no control over my life. I need your help." And she said, "My husband leaves me unless I can have children, and I can't bear children. What do I do?" And Elizabeth says, "Of course you can't bear children. Children are a gift from God. And as long as you serve the spirits that you have dedicated your life to, you won't have children." And that was the same for each of this woman's four sisters. And so she said, "What do I do?" And she said, "You need to trust. You need to believe in Jesus." So Elizabeth shared with her, presented her testimony, and shared about the living Christ. And this woman wonderfully was saved. And then they brought down all the tools of her trade, of her witchcraft and spiritism worship. The rocks, the spikes that they used, the sacrificial materials, because they used to sacrifice at one time humans, but then communism eradicated that. Then they would sacrifice animals, and it came down to chickens. They would sacrifice chickens. So they brought all these tools down, and they laid them on the altar, and they burnt them. They burnt them in the backyard in a pit, and then they blessed this woman. Within about 6 weeks, this woman became pregnant. Well, guess what? Then the sisters came. They wanted to know how they could be delivered. One by one, Elizabeth led them to the Lord, and then the evangelism just exploded. They started a Bible study in that first woman's house. And in the second woman, at the entrance of the other city, they started five house groups, and the church just took off. But in Elizabeth's words, "My husband was a grain of wheat that fell into the ground. My husband, my marriage died. My son died." So she ended up having to go back, and now her daughter she had the baby. She has now married one of the men in the church. She is the worship leader. And you want to go to a great dance? One of the most exciting events I had was in this evangelism crusade. I was meeting with the pastor and the pastoral staff in the back room. And one of our team came up and they said, "Hermano Darío," you know, "Brother Daryl, you got to come and see this." I said, "What's going on?" They said, "There's a dance." I said, what do you mean a dance?" Well, I went out and it was like a spiritual conga line. People were holding on to each other, and they were kicking their feet up, and they were just praising God and worshiping up and down the aisles. And this was a little beyond the comfort zone of these North Americans I'd brought in, but it was totally within the comfort zone of all these non-Christian Cubans that were there. God was there. And they said, "You got to come out here." Well, we were in there 20 minutes, and the pastor's wife, or the Elizabeth's daughter, said, "Some of you have come here to find the answers for your need. God is here. You need to be saved." She made an altar call. 25 people came forward without us there, without us asking, without us preaching. It wasn't about us. It was about God's presence there. And God showed up. God didn't need us to do his work. And I'll tell you, the presence of God was so powerful that when she made the altar call, it just flooded. We kind of messed things up by still feeling we had to preach and still feel we had to give out the little prizes that we had brought to attract the neighbors. But God was so present there, that church just exploded. But in her words, "My daughter, my son, my husband were that grain of wheat. But I'm asking for God to restore my marriage, to restore my home, and to give back years of plenty for those years of lean. He's doing it spiritually in Bahia Onda, and it's no longer a hidden bay. It's now a lighthouse in that community. Let me share about Pablo Fernandez. You go, when you look at Pablo, he looks a little odd. He's kind of a little shy, and you look, and one eye is kind of off. And there's something a little bit wrong with him, and you wonder, okay, what's going on? When I first met him, I was introduced by Pastor Juan de Dios, which means John of God. And he has an interesting story, too. But in short, this pastor, Pablo Fernandez, his mother and his brother and sister, 9 and 10 years old, were... Their father literally walked out on them. And so they left, walked out on them, and he was just going through agony. The mother, I should say, was going through agony. She was rejected. They had no means of income, struggling along under the Cuban embargo and with a limited food. And so she went to work at a factory, and the director of the factory... He was a married man, had 3 kids of his own. Well, they had a sexual relationship. And in this relationship, she became pregnant. And so in agony, she's working through all of this, and she decided to save his name and to save her name, she needed an abortion. So she went down, had the abortion. And at 3 months, the baby was aborted. She went back to work, and they carried on. Well, at 6 months, she realized she continued to grow. And so she went in and realized that they had only aborted 1 of a set of twins. So she went back to have a second abortion. At 6 months, they injected her with saline, and the womb aborted the baby. They threw it in a garbage. They went out to clean her up. The nurse came in to fix up the delivery room, and heard a sucking sound, looked down in the garbage, and here was this baby sucking its thumb. And so the nurse reached down and took out that little premature baby boy, 1.5 pounds, cleaned it off, gave it to the mother. The mother took Pablo home. And he was raised in a home where the grandmother lived with them, and the grandmother wanted him to be, she was a spiritist as well, wanted him to be a Catholic priest. And so it's a syncretism of Catholicism melded with the African spirits, Santeria. And so she was training him, sending him to catechism to train to be a priest. And when he continued to grow and get healthy and gained his strength, God delivered him mightily. And at 17, he was going off to his classes at the church, and he heard all this singing and the celebration coming from a garage, or a garage, depends if you're Canadian or American. And so he wondered, what's going on? And it was all these young people outside, just alive and vibrant. So he went inside because there were some good-looking girls in there. And it was a Baptist church. Went in, and they were celebrating Jesus Christ. Well, when you've had a vacuum of spirituality for 45 years, now 50 years now, and he was attracted to all this, and he went in, and the pastor noticed that a guest was there, gave a direct altar call. He came forward, and then the young people surrounded him and prayed for him, befriended him, and he realized, this is what I've wanted, this is what I've lacked in my life. Gave his life over to Christ, and he began to attend that church and began to train for the ministry. Well, we came along, and he switched from the Baptist to the Pentecostal church, which my friend is pastoring, and he says, Daryl, he says, I've got these young students that are church planners. Can you help us out with support? And I said, sure. And he says, one of our guys is just about to be married. And I said, oh, really? Well, introduce me. So I met Pablo, and he had He moved into a small little house, and his garage they had just converted into a meeting place for their church. And basically, they live in three rooms on one side, and they use the garage for their meeting area, but it needed a roof on it. It needed a little bit of a fence to keep the neighbors from dogs from wandering over. So we helped them out with that. And he says, we're just starting today. You're here for our first start. So that was kind of exciting. And he says, meet my wife, and her name is Odalis. She had been married to a high government communist official, alcoholic, and he used to beat her and beat. She had never been able to bear children. And so he divorced her, but he came back home. Whenever anything new in her life, when he found out she was a Christian, he came back home and beat the tar out of her, even though they were divorced. But on one of the makeup sessions, she had... it kind of ended in divorce when she had become pregnant. This was the last time he had been in the home. And when she was 7 months pregnant, he came home and threw her down and kicked her repeatedly in the stomach and beat her with a chair. And she was afraid that she had lost the baby. And so she tried to run away from him. He ran after her, and she got some gasoline and poured it on him. And she took a match. She said, if you don't leave now, I'm going to set you on fire. And so he left, and that's when they went through the divorce. Well, the baby was born premature. Its brain was, it wasn't fully formed. Its heart, he had a hole in his heart, and his stomach wouldn't allow him to digest food. So for months they prayed. Meanwhile, Pablo had started in that church, and he was well on in his pastoral training. Well, the two of them fell in love. He just had a compassion for this woman bringing a child alone into the world. But he wanted to respect that she had been divorced, and so they allowed the child to be born, and then they married, and the two of them were starting this church together when I came along. So I was back there this last summer when they had dedicated the church. They had 50 members of the church, and they had asked me to preach at that service. And they now had a roof on, they had walls on the garage, and they even had a front metal door to allow people in. But that church was on fire. And he said the same thing. He said, there was a sacrifice. I somehow believe that God saved me for a reason, for a purpose. And my sister, my twin sister, was the grain of wheat. And I explained about this grain of wheat. He said, my sister was that grain of wheat that died. And God is adding his increase. You could multiply that 900 times, these stories, amongst the pastors in Cuba. All of them have a story, phenomenal story. But we have seen Cuba literally exploding. And the exciting news, this is the first public time I've announced this. In May and June of 1999, the government allowed the Cubans to have celebrations in 20 key cities. There were 22 celebrations because there were two in Havana and two in another city. The government has now given permission to have those celebrations again. This is 10 years later. Those celebrations removed the fear. Our goal is to put over 100,000 Bibles, 100,000 New Testaments, 100,000 books into Cuba, to bring in discipleship materials from other groups. We are doing a marriage seminar, and we will commit to putting in the tools to reaching Cuba for Christ. We feel this is a key opportunity. And so God is reaping a great harvest. He's given us an unparalleled opportunity. And I believe when the embargo is gone and materialism floods in, the revival will be finished. And so we believe this is kind of an end of the day's harvest. So pray for that. Pray that God would open the doors for now, allow us to go through and to make a great commitment in this end times harvest. So that's happening in May and June of next year. And I'm doing everything I can to kind of pick it up. WorldServe will bring in books and Bibles, and we want to keep supporting these pastors. But this is it's great news. But it involves sacrifice. And I want to close with this story. Remember when Britain was under the monarchy and the kind of a feudal landlord system, and the first prime minister in Britain, can anyone remember who the first prime minister in Britain was? Shame on you as a Brit. Oliver Cromwell was named the first prime minister, and he realized to really get this nation alive and moving ahead, we need to establish a monetary system. We need to find the gold and the silver in Britain and be minting a monetary system to give stability to the economy and to the nation. And so they couldn't find any gold or silver. The land was poor. The gold and silver was all gone. So he sent his members of government out to find out where the gold and silver is. And they came back. They said, listen, we found the gold and the silver that we found are in statues. They are the saints of the church. That's the gold and the silver. The gold and silver are in the, they are the saints, the Catholic saints in the church. And so he said, go and fetch the saints. We need to melt the saints down and put them into circulation. And so they did. They went into the churches. They got the churches to donate the saints, these gold and silver saints, upon which the monetary system of England was established of that day. And put them into circulation. And there was a sacrifice. And we're seeing today that God is fulfilling his promise. He is bringing this end times harvest that he's promised. But it involves sacrifice. It involves the sacrifice, some through prayer, through fasting, some through giving, some through serving. It's all of the above. And God is just adding his increase and adding his blessing. When you pray for revival in Canada, it's going to cost. But you know what? We're seeing this tremendous missionary movement is touching every corner of the globe. God's return is very close. Very close. Closer than we dare to think. But when you go abroad, you see these tongues, tribes, and nations coming to God, and God is winning Cuba for Christ. Thank you for your prayers. Thank you, Tri-Cities Vineyard, for your tremendous encouragement and prayer and support for us personally. You are awesome. And thank you for being a part of this end times harvest. The Lord bless you, and continue to remember this Cuban celebration next year. And continue to remember China in your prayers, the Olympics, who knows what's going to happen there, Burma, so many other nations, Africa, Ethiopia. That's for another day, and I'll tell that on another day. But Bob, thanks for having me, and thank you as a church for having me in.
Thanks, Daryl. Okay, we'll dismiss the children. There's not very many kids here today, is there? The ones that are will be out soon. And Daryl's going to hang around for an hour or two so you can chat with him. Yeah. And pick his brain some more. And we'll see some of you next week. We'll see all of you next week, some at the service, some at the camp. So, God bless. Have a good week.